When Elie Wiesel was 15, the Jews of his town in Hungary were forced by the Nazis to live behind barbed wire in a ghetto. In 1944, before Wiesel turned 16, he and all the Jews of his town were deported to concentration camps. Wiesel survived Auschwitz and Buchenwald. Both his parents and one of his sisters died in the camps. Wiesel became one of the first survivors to devote his life to bearing witness to the Holocaust. He's remained one of the most committed and impassioned. In 1985, President Reagan presented him with the Congressional Gold Medal of Achievement. In 1986, Wiesel won the Nobel Peace Prize. The Nobel Committee cited him as one of the most important spiritual leaders and guides in an age of violence and racism. Wiesel is the author of many novels and essays. In a recent essay, he wrote, "Why do I write? Perhaps in order not to go mad, or on the contrary, to touch the bottom of madness." Madness is the subject of his new novel, Twilight. It's about a Holocaust survivor who years later visits an asylum where all the patients have delusions that they are biblical characters. The novel explores the differences between madness and mystical vision. I asked Wiesel if this theme is related to his statement that he wrote to keep from going mad.
I have written so many books, I think around 30, all of them, and somehow they are all connected. One major theme that I think runs through most of my stories, my tales, is madness. I've always been fascinated by madness and haunted by another kind of madness, mystical madness, clinical madness. Today there is so much madness in the world, including political madness, that one cannot not pay attention to it.
What do you mean when you say you've been hounded by madness?
Meaning haunted. I have known madmen in my town, and they had a profound influence on me. And since then, either they themselves are still present, or I'm looking for what is mad. I mean, again, mystically mad in human beings.
I think your new book continues your life work of bearing witness about the Holocaust, but also struggling with the questions raised by the Holocaust.
Well, there too, my very first book was called Night. And all the questions actually that are confronting me today have already been posed there. Man's relationship to himself, our relationship to other people, our fate in humankind. And ultimately, what should be my attitude towards God?
Why have you made it your life work to bear witness?
Well, what else could one do? Having gone through certain events, I believe a human being, if he or she wants to remain human, then he or she must do something with what we have seen, endured, witnessed. Not to live through an experience when the experience is there, it's bad, but not to communicate it is worse.
You know, I think that it's almost a human instinct to let time dim memories of horror and tragedy. Have you fought that in a way? Have you tried to keep those memories alive so that you can continue to communicate about them?
Well, naturally. I mean, naturally, the human being wants to forget pain. In this case, all those, or most of those, who went through the experience during the war, they want to remember more and more and more. They go deep into their own consciousness, into their own memory, trying to find more events, more faces, more eyes, more words, more sighs, more tears, more agonies. It's never enough because we feel that we have to tell the story, and no one can tell the story fully.
How often do you find yourself thinking about your experiences in the camps?
Oh, I rarely speak about myself, and since you ask, of course, I think about it every day.
Are there certain things that will bring up those memories?
Yes, when I see a child who is hungry, I see a person who is humiliated, when I see what is happening all over the world today, the violence, the stupid, arrogant, grotesque violence that is dominating humankind, I cannot not remember that there were other times. Of course, I never compare.
My guest is Elie Wiesel, who, by the way, has written a new novel which is titled Twilight. You once described Auschwitz as the defeat of the intellect that wants to find a meaning with a capital M in history. Do you feel that nevertheless you've been really spending your life trying to find some meaning of of the Holocaust, some larger meaning it could tell us about man or about God?
Terry, all the questions I had remain open. I really don't believe that I found any answer to any one of the questions I had. I don't know the meaning. I don't know why it happened. I don't know how it happened. I still don't know anything, really. I'm trying to tell a story, and even the story cannot be told, and therefore it cannot be communicated, and therefore people deep down, I know, won't receive the testimony that we are giving. We are a very special kind of writers, those who write about that event. And I write very little about it, really, but I know that people will not understand.
Well, in fact, I think when you started talking about the Holocaust, you found it very difficult to find people who would listen.
Oh, nobody wanted to listen. My first book, Night, which appeared in France in 1958, we couldn't find a publisher for it. Finally, we found a very small publisher, a marvelous man, Arthur Wenck, who I think gave us $50 in advance, and maybe 3,000 copies were printed. I don't think they were sold. Nobody read. People didn't want to listen.
Why do you think that changed?
Slowly. First of all, we worked slowly with children, with their teachers. It was a slow process. And deep down, I think also, people began understanding that here we are confronted with an event unlike any other, which cannot be compared to any other event, unprecedented. And it is an important event. I believe this event to be the most important event of the 20th century and perhaps of all centuries. And therefore, people somehow wanted to know more.
I think when you were in the camps, you saw some religious people stop praying and saw people who had not been observant turn to God. You had been very observant and very immersed in the religious texts when you were young, before you were deported to the concentration camps. How did your experiences and your survival in the camps change your own experience of religion?
Well, the change, to the extent that it occurred, did not occur there. It's afterwards that the problems became urgent. Inside that universe, we continued praying, we continued believing, we continued affirming. We needed that link with our past. It's only after the war that I began asking questions, and I began articulating a certain protest. And that protest is still with me. I am still angry at all the forces in history that provoked such a catastrophe. That doesn't mean that my fate left me or that I left my fate. I try to develop a certain protest within fate.
Have you gone back to the religious texts that you were reading when you were young?
I never stopped reading or studying. Even inside that universe, I studied. I had a teacher there whose name I never knew and whose face I hardly saw. But he was a teacher, head of a Talmudic school in Galicia. And we worked together and we studied together. I know it's incredible.
This is in the camps?
Inside, in Auschwitz. So we studied. We kept on studying from morning to evening. And after the war, the first thing I wanted was a book, was a Talmudic treatise. I never stopped studying. That probably saved me.
In your new novel, Twilight, it's partially set in an institution where all the people who are mad envision themselves characters in the Bible. And one of the people in this institution thinks that he is God. And he is asked all the questions some of the questions that you have, I'm sure, asked yourself about how God could allow something like the Holocaust to happen. What does it mean in terms of your understanding, your feelings about God, that you've created this character who is mad and thinks he's God and maybe is God? It's very ambiguous.
Oh, please, I think it's deeper than that. I created a character who thinks that he meets another character who thinks that he is God. God, if God answered, he answered in his language, whereas we ask the questions in our language, and I'm not sure it's the same language. So we keep on asking and interrogating, questioning. The silence of God is God.
In your first novel, Night.
Night was not a novel, it was a memoir.
I don't know why I think of it as a novel.
Oh, no.
I think of it as a very autobiographical novel.
It is autobiography, but yeah. Every word is true.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you about your religious teacher who narrowly escaped from being murdered with hundreds or thousands of other Jews in the forest by the SS, and he somehow managed to escape and come back to your village to warn people about what was happening, and no one would listen.
We didn't listen because he was a simple man. He was a beadle. Had he been an important person, I think some people would have listened. What is so extraordinary is when we remember today the silence, the indifference of so many people who were not inside the tragedy, but on the other side. Just imagine if we had heard on the radio Ben-Gurion from Israel, or Roosevelt, or Churchill, telling Hungarian Jews, don't go because they are killing, they are massacring. I think we would have believed them. But why should one believe a beadle, a man who came back from the other side and who is telling such atrocious stories?
Well, getting back to the question of madness, I think a lot of people in your village just assumed he'd lost his mind and was was having visions or something, that this couldn't possibly have happened.
Oh, absolutely. I myself, I was very close to him. And we spent many, many hours alone together every evening. And I would listen to him. First, I love to listen to stories, even to his stories, maybe especially to his stories. But I didn't believe them.
Did you do anything to mentally prepare for what was in store when your father told you that the next day the whole village was going to be deported, the whole ghetto was going to be deported?
No, we didn't know. See, Hungarian Jewry was deported at such a pace. Everything came so fast. Look, the Hungarians allowed the Germans to come in March. The end of May, all the Jews were out already in Germany. In less than 6 weeks, Eichmann had managed to deport to their death more than 600,000 Jews, men, women, and children. So it came very fast, and it ended very fast. We didn't have time to think.
You've described yourself as having been very weak and sickly when you were young. I know you think of yourself as having survived purely by chance. Did you learn things, though, to help you survive when you were in the camps?
Oh, no, not at all. I was the wrong person, the wrong candidate for survival. I was always weak, as you said, and disarmed, cowardly. I would never try to do anything which was not what I could have done or should have done. I never asked for a supplement of anything. I didn't volunteer. I was always pleased to think that I could be invisible. Not to make myself visible was my task. I don't know why I survived. I don't know how I survived. It was really by accident.
My guest is Elie Wiesel, who has really spent his life bearing witness about the Holocaust, and he's written a new novel. It's called Twilight. We're going to talk more about his life after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Elie Wiesel is my guest, and he won a Nobel Peace Prize just a couple of years ago for his work. After the war, you were supposed to be repatriated and sent back to your home, but you didn't want to go there. Why didn't you want to return?
Because there was no one waiting for me there. Unlike the non-Jews, really, who were also deported, they could go back to their families, to their home, to their peoples. We had nowhere to go. I knew that my father died. I was there. I was convinced that my little sister and my mother also perished. I had two older sisters. I didn't know that they survived. So why go back? And therefore I was together with 400 other young boys waiting for any country to open its gates for us. Our ideal, really, would have been to go to Palestine, but the British didn't allow us to go to Palestine. De Gaulle heard about our plight and he invited us to France, so we came to Paris. And therefore, really, I feel very close to French culture and to the French humanism, which occasionally one finds even in the highest places. And therefore, all of my books have been written in French, including Twilight.
Did you know when you got out of the camps that you wanted to write?
Oh, I knew that I was going to write before I entered the camps. I come from a tradition, from the Jewish tradition, which believes in words, in language, in communication. And already at the age of 12 or 13, I was writing. Of course, it wasn't good. It meant nothing, but I tried to write. I even found the manuscript when I went back to my hometown. It's not good, but I tried. Afterwards, I knew I would have to bear witness. Everyone who was there is a witness. And everyone who was there is a true witness. Others who are trying to speak about this subject occasionally are false witnesses. And I felt that I had to be a true witness, and therefore I decided to wait for 10 years, not to speak about it, not to use language related to these experiences until I knew that the words were true words.
Why 10 years? Why not 5 years? Why not 1 year? No, seriously, what made you think that 10 years is what you needed to really know what it was you wanted to say and what words you wanted to say it with?
Well, 10 is a biblical figure, you know, and it's a good figure. Why not? I cannot tell you that I got up one morning and decided that, let's see, is it 5 or 6 or 7? It entered my mind, it has to be 10. I decided 10.
Did you actually have an anniversary where, like, the 10th, really?
Absolutely.
And that day you sat down to write?
Right.
And is that when you started to write Night?
I wrote Night, yes. That's when I wrote Night, on April 11, 1955, which is 10 years later.
And looking back, do you think that this was definitely the right thing to do, to wait those 10 years? In what ways were you changed as a witness and as a writer during those 10 years?
Maybe I didn't change, but the words in me changed. They grew. You know, words have a strange destiny too. They grow, they get old, they die, they come back. Words can be turned into spears. They can be turned into prayers. It's a strange world that you are in when you deal with words.
In one of your essays, you wrote that after the war, you deliberately avoided all contact with Germans and that their presence sickened you physically. Did that change, and if so, what changed that?
It did. Well, I didn't want to go back to Germany, really. I went once because I didn't want to judge people. I went once in the early 60s to do a piece for Commentary. And I realized that every person I see in the street, I judge him or her, asking where was he, what did he do, how old is he, could he have been there? And I didn't want that role, so I didn't go back. But I did go back last year, or in 86, 87. And look, today you have a young generation of Germans, and I do not believe in collective guilt. So I have absolutely no problem with the young Germans. I even feel sorry for the young Germans, because to be maybe sons or daughters of killers is different than to be sons and daughters of the victims. And I felt sorry for them. I still do.
Writer and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel is my guest. You have a son, and I'm wondering if when your son was born, it helped give you a reason to live beyond bearing witness?
Well, it's enough, you know, to bear witness can be a very exalting undertaking. To have a son is also to bear witness. A son who has the name of my father is an important statement. But it is true that the birth of my son divided my life.
Did you find yourself reliving your childhood memories as you watched your son grow?
Terry, my son would not like me to talk about him.
That's fine. Let me drop it then. I understand that fully. You said something about bearing false witness before, that you wanted to bear witness because there were others who would bear false witness. And I wonder if you see a lot of examples of false witness around you now. And by that I mean maybe some of the movies or novels or something that you might think don't ring true, or...
Well, there is too much vulgarization and commercialization and trivialization mm-hmm. of the subject. It's much too much. It began years ago, and the wave is rather high. It goes too far. And these, I believe, although the intentions may be good, but these are statements made by false witnesses. The Holocaust is not a cheap soap opera. The Holocaust is not a romantic novel. It is something else. Now, furthermore, that there are even people who totally deny that it existed. Today you have many, many pseudo-scholars who totally deny that Auschwitz ever existed. So I believe that faced with the embellishment of the tragedy on one hand and the denial of the tragedy on the other, we who are still here must pick up as forcefully and gently as possible and say, look, this is not the way it was.
The generations of survivors are getting older. The older generation of survivors is no longer with us. Are you concerned about what's going to happen after the generations of survivors pass on? Like, who will be around to actually speak the memories?
Oh, I'm profoundly concerned, naturally. In one of my novels, I try to describe that feeling of the last survivor, what it means to be the very last. And I would not want to be that last survivor. But on the other hand, we are leaving a legacy. We are bequeathing a certain message, a certain story. This tragedy is the most documented tragedy in recorded history. And therefore, later on, if there will be a later on, anyone wishing to know will know where to go for knowledge.
You won the Nobel Peace Prize a couple of years ago, not only for bearing witness, but for the work that you've done with current tragedies. When did you start thinking that you wanted to not only bear witness, but to apply that somehow to current disasters?
Well, for many, many years. I think it began in the early 60s. First, I went to the Soviet Union to see the plight and the resistance of Soviet Jewry. And that drew me into the field of human rights. And I broadened the scope of that activity because I do believe that as a Jew, I should, of course, see Jewish concerns as my priorities. It's only normal, it's only natural, but they should not be exclusive. I do not believe that as a Jew I have the right not to know what is happening to the poor people in Africa, to victims of oppression in Asia or in communist countries. I do not have the right not to know and not to try to help.
What kind of action do you feel you can take to try to help?
Well, what can I do? I'm not a politician. I have no position. All I can do is write. I can take a few words and publish them. I went to help the Miskito Indians. I published in all kinds of newspapers, press conferences. I went to the Soviet Union. I wrote a book. I went to Argentina. I wrote about it. Wherever I go, again, it's one more way of bearing witness.
In a way, you recently bore witness to President Reagan before he went to Bitburg, to the cemetery to speak there. You spoke with him. You spoke to him publicly in a public address. But I think you might have had a personal audience with him as well. Did you?
Oh, I'll tell you. I tried, you know, to be respectful, and I think I was. And he by the way, he thanked me for it. I showed him my speech before I delivered it, a day before I made that statement in the White House when he gave me the Congressional Gold Medal. One day before, I wanted him to read what I was going to say. One does not surprise a president. It's not nice. It's not to be done. So I did that, and I met him that morning too, just an hour before the ceremony. I'll tell you, I think it was a watershed. I think it was the wrong thing to do. I think he, from his viewpoint, he felt he had no choice. But somehow, there must be justice in history. All the people who were involved in the Bitburg affair are out of the White House now.
Your new novel, Twilight, is the first novel that you've written since receiving the Nobel Peace Prize. Was that... Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. No, I've written it before. I published it after.
Oh. Well, in that case, and then I'm still wondering if getting that prize was intimidating at all and has made it more difficult to write, you know, living up to the Nobel.
No, I really don't think so, because when one writes, one doesn't think of prizes. It made it more difficult afterwards. People somehow do not receive it the same way. A Nobel laureate carries a certain, I don't know, a certain mystique, which is silly. And therefore they judge the book differently. If the same book had appeared, let's say, 10 years ago, it would not have been judged the way it is being judged now.
You mean you're being judged as the Nobel winner?
As the Nobel winner. So people expect different things from a Nobel winner.
Is this helping you or hurting you?
Neither, really. This is my 30th book, so it's not something that touches me.
Are you in the middle of writing another book now?
Oh, I always am in the middle of writing a book. I never give a manuscript to a publisher before I've begun another one.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Elie Wiesel, and he's now a professor in the humanities at Boston University. He's the author of more than 30 books. His new book is titled Twilight, and it's just been published by Summit Books. He won his Nobel Peace Prize in 1986. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.